Welcome, and thanks for joining us at Hangar 46, the Air and Space Power Centre's podcast for the Royal Australian Air Force. At Hangar 46, we discuss a range of topics from emerging air and space power challenges, international relations, technology, ethics, culture, and so much more. We have an impressive lineup of guests. I trust you'll find them informative, at times provocative, and most importantly, entertaining. If there's someone you think we should invite to Hangar 46 for a chat, please reach out and let us know. Find us online at Air and Space Power Centre. Thank you and enjoy the episode.
Hi everyone and welcome to Hangar 46 podcast of the Air and Space Power Centre of the Royal Australian Air Force. My name is Group Captain Joe Brick and this afternoon I am with Dr. Claire York from Deakin University. Dr. York is an author, academic advisor, specialising in the role and limitations of empathy and emotions in security, international affairs, politics, leadership and society. She's currently a senior lecturer with Deakin University at the Australian War College in Canberra. Previously, she was working in Denmark as a fellow for the Centre of War Studies at the University of Southern Denmark. In this role, she led a project on empathy and international security funded by the European Union's Horizon 2020 Fund. And from 2018 to 2020, she was a Henry A. Kissinger postdoctoral fellow and lecturer at International Studies and the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. She finished her PhD in international relations at the Department of War Studies in King's College London in 2018. And you can find out about more of Dr. York's work at her website, clareyork.me. And we'll have all the links in the website for you at your favourite podcasting app. So, Dr. York, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, empathy is a word that is often, well, not often, associated with the hard business of military and international security. But I do note, as every good staff college student, that military strategist called Sun Tzu, depending on which lecture you had at staff college, said, know the enemy and know yourself, and in 100 battles you'll never be in peril. What are your sort of initial comments about empathy?
So I would define empathy as an attempt to understand how other people experience and see the world. So we often say it's stepping into someone else's shoes, but it's also a way of understanding where they're coming from, their history, their background, the context within their working, whether that's socioeconomic context or maybe the political, geopolitical situation that they're in. It's also, for me, about understanding emotions, and that's why I think using this term empathy is so important, because it's about shining a light on how different people create meaning, how security feels, how certain experience feel, and how we therefore help to create different meanings of the world and our experiences.
Oh, that's fantastic, because I think it's one of those words that you can get into the what I call the princess bride dilemma of using a word that you don't actually know what it means. So thank you very much for those introductory remarks about what empathy is. But I guess we're here to talk about a little different perspective, and it's a term called strategic empathy. One that I first became interested in when I read an article by the retired US Army General H.R. McMaster. He wrote an article in The Atlantic in 2020 called How China Sees the World and How We Should See China. In that article, he recounts his time as a national security advisor to the then President Trump in a state visit to Beijing. And in the article, he recalls Professor Zachary Shaw's work in A Sense of the Enemy, where he looks at the concept of strategic empathy. So can you define what that is, just in terms of the different context from the definition you stated earlier?
Yeah, so the first concept was the generic idea of empathy as we understand it in the everyday, and it has multiple applications. But then in the context of strategy, I approach it as how do we use empathy in order to make better decisions, in order to have a deeper, more nuanced and complex view of the landscape, the security landscape, the political landscape in which we're operating. And it's designed as a way to inform this iterative process of strategy and decision making. It should compel us, especially for self-reflection, because I know in the article he also talks about strategic narcissism and this importance of humility within decision making, not assuming that you know the output, not assuming that you have the answers and that you can divine what's in the mind of someone else without really doing the work to understand it. And so for me, it's much more targeted at making better decisions and avoiding some of the real strategic errors that we've seen, especially when we think about, for example, Vietnam, Afghanistan, where an absence of empathy led to a few policy failures that had real costs and significant implications.
That sounds really... Can we dig into that a little bit more, actually? Can you say more about the examples that you just highlighted, whether it's Afghanistan or Vietnam? I guess pick one or the other.
Yeah, so one of the easy and interesting access points for empathy within this kind of security and conflict context is in the case of Vietnam. There's a book and a film, The Fog of War, with Secretary of Defense, former US Secretary of Defense, Robert S. McNamara, and he talks about how his biggest lesson from his time in office was this imperative of empathizing with your enemy. And it was the failure of the United States to fully understand why the North Vietnamese were fighting, why the Viet Cong were fighting, that meant that they expended a huge amount of money and military men and women, and resources on this conflict without really getting to the crux of what it was about. And so he says, if we'd have known this, we might have ended the war much sooner. We may not have entered it in the same term. And so it's quite a nuanced appreciation for how he can see it evolving differently had there been empathy. And he's written a number of books on it that are very accessible for people in the policymaking space.
Right. So is it essentially, it just makes me think of the military planning process when we do the problem framing and problem definition. From what you said, it sounds like it was almost like an unsuccessful attempt at defining the problem. Is that essentially what happened? We didn't know what they were trying to achieve and therefore what we were trying to achieve. Is that what you sort of meant?
Yes, and in part because there wasn't sufficient effort expended to understand the people themselves, to get into the mindset of why might they be fighting. And it's so interesting to see that once you dig into it and they start to get access to these different Vietnamese perspectives, they're not necessarily fighting for communism to win, but fighting for liberation. And it's interesting, I was digging through some of the archives from American diplomacy with China, and it's fascinating to see the Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai advise Kissinger to have empathy with the Vietnamese because they're fighting for similar reasons that the Americans fought the British,
right,
for this kind of liberation and independence. And I think they missed that context. And obviously there's more nuance to it, there's more layers, it's not that simple. But the inability to see the world through the eyes of others and to also reflect on how we might, or how, you know, how America might be experienced by the world, meant that there were real flaws in some of the decision making, some miscalculations that were costly.
Right. How about in Afghanistan? What's the sort of, what would you say about that conflict? Was it similar, a similar problem or?
So with Afghanistan, again, it's this, and I'm sure you all know far more about this than I do. I'm a civilian, but there was a sense, and there's been some written on this, that again, there was a failure to fully understand the Taliban's aims, their objectives, their motivations, but also their sources of power, the kind of ways in which they crafted narratives, the ways in which they gained support, and the kind of local power structures and configurations of Afghan society, of the ability of the Taliban and those who supported them for strategic patience to just outlast the people who were in their country because they'd done it so many times before. And so there's some work done by Matthew Waldman on strategic empathy in Afghanistan. That's another one where they talk about it, another document.
Okay, no, thank you. Definitely look into that. I've never heard that before. You just reminded me of that amazing spaghetti. I call it the spaghetti diagram from Afghanistan. I think it was our attempt to understand what was actually happening.
How it's so complex. It's just like someone's thrown spaghetti on a wall.
That's right. Everything is connected to everything else. Now, I'm just going to take you to probably, I think, is a great starting point into your work. It was an article in the journal Strategic Studies that you wrote in December 22 called Is Empathy a Strategic Imperative? A review essay. And there's an amazing turn of phrase that I really love. And I'll just quote from the article. You wrote that your strategy is about achieving certain desired ends and meeting core objectives, whether in warfare, politics or policy. Then empathy is critical to understanding the contours of the human landscape in which such aims are to be achieved. And so can you say more about the value then of empathy from two perspectives? Firstly, in policy development, so the creation of this sort of normative framework for us to see our strategic relationships perhaps, and then the practical implementation of how we actually execute strategy. Can you say more about those two things?
Yes, and I also want to reflect a little bit more on this core assumption that is in that quote, but also in my work, that we have to view the security space and the political political space is intrinsically human. And there's often this tendency to try and privilege rationality as if we are beings who behave in an ordered, logical way. And actually, we're not. We're complex beings. All humans are. We respond to our environments in different ways. And it's, I think, unhelpful to create too much of a division between reason and emotion, because really sound decision-making should be informed by a judicious use of emotion. We need to have emotionally intelligent, emotionally literate, emotionally agile leaders who are able to say, this is how these emotions are shaping my perspectives. This is how they're giving me the lens. But also, this is how I can connect most effectively with the audiences I'm trying to reach, whether that's within a military organization or a government department or in politics. And so kind of putting more of the humanity into security policy and politics is, to me, critical to doing it well, rather than stripping it out and trying to have it just be about data points and something that you can measure very easily, but that misses the nuance and the contours. So it's a long answer to then get to this first one about how it helps in the perspective of policy development. And if we think, for example, about security policy in its broadest sense, not just defense, but kind of security policy, it's about how do we think about how security is experienced by different people. And it's very easy for those of us, especially within the field of defense and security, to have certain assumptions about how things work and what security means. And so it's about opening up the process to think about how other people might experience it. And especially, for example, in places like Australia, how might Indigenous communities experience security in a different way? How might island nations that you engage with experience security in a different way? And how do we have those conversations to get to the crux of what makes people feel secure? Again, going back to that importance of emotions. And I think by doing that, you also then create a richer picture where security is not just measured in material terms or in terms of hard power or interests, but actually then it's about ideas and narratives and sense of belonging and identity, how people connect with other people, about communities. And then that opens up actually a lot of different opportunities for more creative policy when we want to make people in communities feel secure. Is it about police numbers and military numbers, or is it maybe about effective, very well-run hospitals, about access to schools, about welfare? You know, there's other questions that fall out of that that create a richer picture of security. So empathy then is about, in policy development, getting out and talking to people far more. It's about listening to different perspectives, being open and curious to them. It's about having the conversations within the policy development team. Are we bringing the right people into the room? Are we enabling critical voices? Are we allowing challenge function and not seeing that as a challenge to our own egos or our own worldviews and kind of saying, okay, well, why is it that you maybe think differently? And then being able to be iterative, not being wedded to one approach and keeping it that way. And then in the practical implementation and the strategy execution, again, it's about that process. There's a lot to say on this, so I'll try and keep it short. It's about that process of continued engagement with the audiences and communities that you're working with. So being able to be iterative, reflecting on how things are developing in practical terms, not just in the way in which it's imagined, the way in which envisioned in an abstract office.
So it's like a living thing, really. Like there's an emergent strategy aspect to this.
Yeah, and so iterating. And then also how you communicate it. And this is really important, is when we're doing policy and strategy, the strategic communications piece, the process of communicating why something is important, why it matters, and why we're doing it. And I keep saying we're, I'm not Australian, but it's a turn of phrase. How do you then communicate from the outset that strategic communications is not the add-on bit of messaging that comes at the end? It's built into your strategy design at the outset. How are people going to interpret this? What are they going to be concerned about? What are they going to need to hear? How do we get that message out? How do we build in listening to it? And then through the process of the execution, building that communications throughout that's as open and transparent and honest as possible, that allows for errors without tying you too much to one outcome, which then limits your ability to iterate, which you might need to make the policy better.
That was, there's so much to unpick. So let's unpick some of those things. I think you highlighted really, I guess it's the emergent strategy piece and the need to iterate things. And I feel that sometimes we tend to set a strategy and then just sort of sits there. I guess the next question really is about how to unpick some of those challenges. In that vein, then what are some of the sort of practical challenges in taking these empathetic approaches to conflict and war?
There's a number. One of them that really stands up to me is the politics of it. And I'm really fascinated in the politics of empathy, because especially if you're dealing with a situation of conflict or war, it's a huge ask to ask the people in the midst of that conflict, victims of horrific violence or trauma, people who are seeing loved ones or homes or land being taken or wherever the situation is, to ask them to empathize.
Yeah.
And so finding the appropriate means by which to introduce this idea of empathy, and often I think it's important that it stays in certain spaces and not others, that maybe it's in your decision-making rooms, and then you find a way to roll it out to help alleviate a conflict, to build reconciliation, to find diplomacy. I also think one of the challenges is that we operate in a media environment where we want easy, neat solutions. You want that 240-character tweet, you want the easy message that's going to get you the front page and communicate clearly, and these environments are not simple, they're complex. And so we have to get better at operating within complex environments in a way that doesn't dumb things down too much, that we lose the ability for nuance and understanding, because understanding is dependent on the complexity and the nuance, knowing that it's never just a simple black and white answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that just sort of brought up for me the issue of measurement.
Mm.
Because, of course, when you look back in Vietnam, I mean, the US went down the rabbit hole of trying to measure success through like things like body count and the quantitative approaches to success, because we want to be able to show progress or something like that. But in the realm of emotions and in human, you know, cognition about a problem, that's very hard to measure. Sort of, has your research taken you through to some of those challenges?
Yes. Trying to find a way to measure it while also being comfortable with the fact that you're never going to get a definitive measurement. I think it's about creating environments where there's a greater capacity for change and critique and challenge function, where they're more inclusive, that you have this openness to different voices. And so measuring it in terms of how people feel able to speak up, how much people are curious and able to explore some of those different questions, those different perspectives, who's in the room.
Yep.
You can measure things like that. Who's being sought out for advice? Are you asking the same 10 people? Are you actually going to different people beyond communities and saying, what does that actually mean for you? But it is hard. It's something that I'm trying to grapple with for my books right now, is when we talk about measuring it, how do you do it?
Fantastic. Well, obviously, we'll all be interested to see what the research you come up with, what it showed. And I guess that probably the only point I'd like to explore with you, given that this is a podcast on Air Power, is Air Power was kind of developed to, you know, strike at the enemy from distance. That was the whole point. We didn't want to be anywhere near them when, you know, military action occurs. So I guess the question is, how do you take an empathetic approach when you are at a distance from your enemy or from the people that you are trying to support?
I think it's an interesting observation about that dynamic of air power, that you are often the most removed in some ways from the battlefield. But one area that is very fascinating to explore further is that of drone pilots, who I believe are also within the Air Force in Australia?
Yeah, we call them uncrewed systems.
Unmanned. Okay.
Yeah, but we do have them, absolutely, and we will in the future. So that is definitely a place that we can explore. But yeah,
and I think in the Air Force it's this uncrewed systems, which is very interesting because they are people who are following the lives of others very closely. And I was in Montgomery, Alabama, in the United States when I was living over there, and we went to talk to some of the Air Force there and especially the drone pilots. And I hadn't appreciated quite how intense that can be for them to follow the lives of certain targets.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, you see them not only as a target, but as maybe a father or a community member or someone who has a life just like their life back home, but in a foreign country. The toll then almost of empathy is something that we have to take seriously within the military, of people who have that kind of exposure to those different perspectives and that very human nature of conflict. Are they being adequately supported? Do we fully understand what we're asking of that? And so empathy then in that dimension has far more of relevance to air power. But then in the kind of more conventional Air Force, it's also then about leadership, about do you have the leaders who can inspire their teams, inspire their people to adopt this mindset? Because for me, empathy, it's an ethos and a practice and a mindset. That's how I think about it. It's something you should embody, constantly practice, and just live. And it's not always going to be easy.
Mm.
We get it wrong. I certainly get it wrong. But by that constant effort to try, we start to build healthier cultures. We start to connect with people in more constructive and sincere ways. And that can only feed into a better culture within the military.
And look, that's a fantastic segue, actually, into the second part of the podcast. So the strategic empathy part of what you discussed, there is so much to explore there. So I'd encourage all the listeners to have a look at Dr. York's work there. This is really just a starting point. You raise a really fantastic point about leadership and empathy, and it gels really well with the recent testimony of the Chief of Air Force, Air Marshal Chipman, in front of the Royal Commission on Defence and Veteran Suicide. And I've got a little part of his testimony here from the transcript where he said, "By far the most important attribute from my perspective when it comes to leadership is empathy, because it's not possible to positively influence people if you aren't empathetic." And I think you've already highlighted the real benefits of empathy from a leadership perspective. Can you talk about some of the challenges of how you can actually actively exercise that from a leadership perspective? And also, I guess, a follow-on question of how do we even grow or develop these kinds of leaders?
And it speaks, I love that quote as well. It speaks very much to what I consider is one of the fundamental things that we as humans need, which is to be seen and to be heard and to feel that we matter. And so if a leader can embody that and a leader can make people feel like they're on their side and they're listening and they care, I think that's enormously powerful, especially and particularly it has to be sincere, it has to be well meant. But it's challenging because in a leadership position, especially in an organization as large as, for example, the Air Force, you're still going to have difficult individuals that you have to deal with. You're still going to have problems that you're going to have to solve. And so for me, there's boundaries of empathy that we also have to talk about, that you can be empathetic, but if you're in a leadership position, you have to be able to communicate, this is a red line. I will be empathetic, but then this is where my empathy stops, or this is where I have to make a decision. And especially in conflict, when you've got often rapid fire decisions, you can't always do it in the moment. And that's really why building it into your practice more generally means that you've already got that resource. You've already used it kind of implicitly to make the decisions that you need when time and resources are very finite and very pressing. And I think one of the other challenges, and I'm curious if you have experiences of this, is I think there's also perceptions that empathy can be a sign of weakness. And I think that can be harder, particularly for women and the LGBTQ community within the military, because we often talk about empathetic leaders like Joe Biden, but then women such as Jacinda Ardern are often seen as being weak for this very same skill. And I think finding a way to balance strength and decisiveness with that kind of empathy and care is something that all genders can do, and something that we have to understand is not a weakness. And I think people respect it more, particularly when it's matched by courage and integrity. And so when I talk about empathy and leadership, I don't just talk about empathy. We need courageous leaders who can make these difficult decisions, who can communicate the hard things when it's tough, and who also can kind of deliver on that vision, taking the people they need with them, and do so in a way where people can see that their words and their actions align.
Oh, look, I think that is really an important point, because empathy is often thought of as a soft skill, which then makes it incompatible in some ways. Strength and courage, which is, as you say, I agree, and it's incorrect, because they're not mutually exclusive.
No.
It takes courage and time to really understand, when you're looking at human issues in the workforce, for example, to really look at the world from that person's perspective, which will inform how you then communicate these things with them. Because more often than not, we tend to sort of fail when we don't communicate well, because we haven't seen how that will be received by the other party. So
yeah, and especially when you're dealing with difficult problems within politics, both organizational politics and societal politics, we've seen how polarized many parts of society have become. To have empathy then for someone who thinks very differently and who feels it very viscerally really needs a strong, courageous leader to say, we've got to solve this. We've got to bridge this division. We've got to tackle this problem head on. And we're going to do it by listening and engaging and understanding and finding ways in which we connect and where we are greater than what it is that's kind of dividing us.
And in fact, that's probably the most important thing in today's world, where there's so much polarization, right? It's our inability to see the world from people's eyes and be a bit more judgmental rather than actually curious and understanding. I guess then, how do we make these magical people? Is it something we can do, or is it more of a we get the people that we have?
I absolutely think you can train empathy. You can encourage it and foster it. I don't think it's an overnight solution. I don't think you just get it suddenly because you decide it's important. It takes concerted effort and practice. Part of it is to do with the metrics of success within an organization. So what do we reward within the organizations we work within, whether that's academia, whether that's the military, whether that's politics? Do we reward the people who always put themselves first and make it to the top at the expense of everybody else? Or do we reward the people that people go to in a crisis, the people who listen, the people who are curious and who bring in other people when it's difficult? We should be rewarding the team players and the people, rather than the kind of the egotist who manages to do things that always serve their own purpose. And so I think it's about the metrics of success and what we reward and what we value. And it's also about creating the spaces for people to practice it. So not shooting down the person who raises a constructive criticism. And so again, it's about evaluating the hierarchies that exist. When is it appropriate to maybe seek out the advice of junior members of a team? How can they give insights that reflect very often different demographics, different backgrounds, because they've come from different experiences from those at the top? How do you maybe challenge some of those hierarchies while also recognizing that you still need that maybe chain of command, you still need that authority figure at the top? But there are ways of changing organizational structures to make people feel more able to bring this kind of empathetic self to the workplace and have it valued.
You're taking notes for this, Limo? Hopefully you are. All the people in education and training, that's a really salient point, I think, for how we grow our leaders in not just the Air Force, but in defence more broadly. Right. So unfortunately, we're sort of running a little bit out of time. I would love to talk to you more. We can absolutely talk for much longer. I just wanted to say thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Claire. Is there anything you wanted to sort of leave as a parting sort of thought on empathy and strategy or empathy and leadership?
I just think it's really encouraging that we're having these conversations. That's where it starts. When you talk about how you get it into organizations and leadership, having conversations about what do these concepts mean in practice? How do we think about them differently? What does it mean for me and my environment? So the fact that we have this conversation to me is, I think, just really, really encouraging. And thank you so much for inviting me in and welcoming me in. It's such a pleasure.
No worries. And I suspect this will probably be the first of many. So there's a lot more to talk to you about in probably future podcasts. But thank you very much for your time. And I just wanted to wrap up with a thought that came to mind when I was reading your work, Claire. And it's from, inspired by Ted Lasso, one of my favorite shows in the world. It's a great quote by Ted, which is, "Be curious, not judgmental." It's really about, be curious about what the world looks like through the eyes of others. It might tell you a bit about why they behave the way they do, and also a bit about your place in their story. And on that note, thank you very much for listening, and thanks for joining us at Hangar 46.
Thanks for joining us at Hangar 46. We'll be back again soon for another chat, but in the meantime, follow us online at Air and Space Power Centre to stay up to date.